Welcome to the FinTech Newscast. This is Steve. Today we've got a special interview with Daniel P. Simon, the author of a new book on FinTech called The Money Hackers, How a Group of Misfits Took on Wall Street and Changed Finance Forever. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news.
All right, let's get started. With me this week is Steve.
Hey, John.
And our guest, Daniel P. Simon. How are you doing?
Hi, very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I like long walks. I am Daniel P. Simon. I am the CEO and co-founder of Vested, which is a communications firm that works exclusively in the financial services space, and I'm the author of the upcoming book, which is being published by HarperCollins, that's called The Money Hackers, How a Team of Misfits Took on Wall Street and Changed Your Money Forever.
Why the book and why now?
Well, why the book? Because, you know, they say everyone's got a book inside them. It was like that, this or a 50 Shades of Grey kind of a thing. And I thought, which one feels more me, more on brand for me? And I've worked in fintech for a long time, so I chose this one. And, you know, why now? I think, well, when I started to write the book, when HarperCollins really talked to me about putting the book together, we were sort of coming just off the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis and the crash and the Great Recession. And that was 2008. Obviously, now it's 2010. The book is written, published, and it's going to be available in the stores in about 6 weeks. But the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis seemed like an interesting moment to look back. And 2008, when you look back on it now with hindsight, was a really, really pivotal moment for fintech, for kind of the emergence of consumer finance as we understand it today. 2008 was this kind of inflection point where it wasn't just about the financial crisis. It was all about the growth of these incredible technologies like social media. Facebook hits 100 million users. The App Store launches on the iPhone. So you have this sort of growth of this incredible and explosion of this technology. And so it seemed like a really good moment in time to kind of look back and see where we've come from, to think that, you know, many of the things that we sort of take for granted today just didn't exist.
Yeah, it's funny to think that was around the time that the iPhone was announced. And that's one of those, such an integral thing in our lives now. It's hard to imagine going back.
And mobile internet, which of course enabled you to do all the other things, and the apps. The app store and the app mindset of taking one thing and doing it really, really well. We take that for granted today. We didn't, that wasn't the case. You know, if you think back only 10 plus years ago, 10, 11, now 12 years ago, you know, the Nokia was the best device that you could, you know, if you were lucky, you could personalize your ringtones. So, but in the world of finance too, you know, you didn't have, there was no peer-to-peer lending. There was no robo-advisory. There was no Acorns, really, where you could sort of save. There was no automated savings app. There was no peer-to-peer payment, certainly not in the U.S. You know, people were still writing checks. And in fact, actually, until recently with the introduction of Zelle, you know, a lot of people still use checks. Europe was maybe a little further ahead on some of this stuff, but the world 10, 12 years ago looks very, very different.
FinTech has really seemed to move forward really strongly in the past few years, especially. The funding levels have been, you know, around the $40 billion range for VC funding. The companies are getting much, much larger, much, much stronger. Are we seeing a point where the big established incumbent financial firms finally have to get nervous? I mean, they haven't given up much market share. The biggest ones are still growing in profit. Do you see them getting really affected in a real way in especially the bottom line?
Not really. No, not at all. Which is, I guess you'd expect. I wrote this book about how, like, you know, the fintech took on the bank, it changed money forever. You probably expect me to say, yeah, the fintechs are gonna win. What wins is the idea, not necessarily the people that brought it to you. In fact, quite often with innovation, for every story of a Kodak or a Netflix, right? So you've got Kodak, you've got like the iPhone camera, you've got Netflix, you've got Blockbuster Video, right? For every story of this kind of like scrappy upstart that just takes on this giant and completely demolishes them, there's like 1,000 examples where the ideas that are introduced by the upstarts are kind of adopted by the incumbents, or, you know, to use a term by Scott Galloway, they become featureized. Mm-hmm. And a good example of that is like Snapchat and Facebook via Instagram, right? So, you know, Snapchat came along and it said, oh, stuff disappears. Our stories, we do stories, they disappear. And Instagram was like, that sounds good, we'll do that. And then they said, well, we'll have filters. Filters are really cool. And Instagram said, that's great, we'll do that. And Snapchat's really suffered. All the ideas they've brought to market become part of the language of social media, the way that we interact on social media today. But they've struggled and they've suffered. And Facebook, you know, particularly Instagram, remains enormously dominant. And that kind of story plays out in fintech too. You know, an idea gets introduced and the incumbents say, yeah, eventually they say yes. This seems like a good idea. And whether that's peer-to-peer payments with Zelle, robo-advisory, every platform has a, every you know, financial institution has a robo-advisory platform of some kind. Free trading, that was this incredible innovation from Robinhood. Well, look what happened.
It's all free now.
It's all free, right? So Schwab makes it free. Cuts the share price of all these companies. TD, they buy TD, and then my client Morgan Stanley buys E-Trade. So now you've got a tech company, a fintech OG like E-Trade, that's kind of forced to sell itself to a very traditional incumbent financial institution. So it's kind of the opposite of a kind of a tech taking over the banks. It's actually the banks taking over the techs, and I think that's going to continue to play out, particularly as the market takes a turn. You're going to see massive consolidation in the fintech space, and you're going to see the banks, who have large incumbent customer bases, lots of entrenched regulatory moats, lots of reasons why they're not, you know, lots of sticky features, just sort of either buy them up or take on what it is that they're doing and offer it for themselves. But that may sound like it's depressing. I think, you know, because to me, the more important thing, and I say this in my book, I say this at in the author's note of the book, like, I can't predict which names will be on the service in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. But I can tell you that the ideas are here to stay, right? Yeah. So Victor Hugo said, no army can withstand the power of an idea whose time has come, right? So that's what the fintechs have brought, is these ideas, right? Take robo-advising, passive investing. Passive investing makes it really easy to invest in the stock market. There is no art or science to picking stocks. Why are you paying 100 basis points to a financial advisor if all they're going to do is pick stocks? You might as well just do it for yourself, or let a robo-advisor do it for you for 35 basis points. That's a really compelling idea. And it's kind of infected the financial industry. You can't get away from that idea. Now, if you look at the total number of assets that like the robo-advisors like Wealthfront, Edmund actually have, it's very, very small. It's a fraction of some of the largest financial institutions, but the idea is permanent. Free at scale, which is a very West Coast mentality, right? Google, Facebook, kind of deliver something free, but at scale. That's what Robinhood introduced, and that's what you get now if you go to Schwab or now Schwab and TD. You can't reverse, you know, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Right? Well, the genie is now out of the bottle on some of these ideas. Who we serve and what we look like in the financial services industry. That's an idea whose time has come. Looking more like the people we serve, serving the underbanked, serving the lower end of the market. That's something that, you know, again, no one would have necessarily took the small firms to take that step before the big guys like Goldman Sachs. Look at Goldman Sachs. They have Marcus. Who would have thought 10 years ago that, you know, the preeminent institutional, you know, investment bank that works with only the top people now has a consumer lending and bank business.
It seems like there's not sort of a movement to do that now. You mentioned Marcus, but also we saw today, or this week rather, with the acquisition of E-Trade by Morgan Stanley, there's sort of a move to go from Wall Street to the Main Street and a move towards more consumer banking as well. But I think that one of the things you mentioned in the book, or one of the themes rather, is that you see that big tech actually poses a bigger threat to the big banks than fintechs do. Can you elaborate on how you see that playing out and how you see sort of, you know, Google with this checking account, Apple with its credit card, them sort of taking more market share away from the big four or five banks rather than, say, the Vero Moneys and Robin Hoods of the world?
Yeah, I mean, look, right now, so let's say neobanking, right? So basic banking services. But a lot of the European neobanks have bet on entering this market. So you've got Revolut, N26, Monzo is talking about coming out here. Now, they have an enormous slog. I'm walking around New York City right now. There's N26 ads all over the sides of buses and bus stops and subways. That's a very expensive way to acquire customers. But you look at something like Amazon, and I mean, I must have purchased four things from Amazon today, right? I'm in there all the time. I think there's a stat that said like Amazon search is like the third largest search after Facebook and Google, and it's actually a big chunk of the search market. Most people don't think of Amazon as a search product. But the amount of data they're gathering...
Their ad revenue is huge now, yeah.
Right. So they're in the natural workflow of our lives. You know, we don't even think about it, right? They already offer kind of installment... They're already offering kind of a lending product to the merchants that sit on their platform. Right, and factoring products and working capital products. So they're kind of already in that life. If they offered a layaway solution for people to purchase things, you know, that's a huge entrance into people's wallets, right? And in some cases, people are being more overt about it, like Google, Apple, Facebook, than others. But I think they... You know, there's two things. One is that they are massively in the workflow of our lives already. And the second thing is I think that they are interested in purchasing data. I think, you know, these are companies that where ad revenue, as you're saying, is a big part of their revenue models. And, you know, what ad you click on is one indicator of your behavior. It's certainly an indication of your intent to buy, but your actual purchase behavior is really kind of who you are. Right? For my own business, I always tell people, don't tell me what you believe in, tell me what you spend money on, because that's ultimately the biggest picture of kind of who you are. You show me your bank statement and I will tell you who you are, right? So I think there's a massive opportunity for these guys, and I think the banks have figured out that Google and Amazon and Facebook intend to make a play in that space.
Just where it suits their need, not in an overall sense. Like you were talking about Amazon, I know they're in the small to medium-sized business loans so that they can sell more on their website. Apple's providing a card that gives some benefits when you buy their products, purely where it's somewhat related to their existing business, and that will probably grow. So, and with the big banks, as you're saying, not changing, what do you see as like some significant changes over the next, let's say, not get too crazy because it's the future, but let's say 5 years?
Well, I think you could look at a country like China, right? And you could look at a product like WeChat and the way that you have this kind of rebundling of products and services. So if 2008 is the unbundling of the banks, right, which is driven by this app mentality, you you look at a China which didn't have any of this infrastructure and has built products that are entirely bundled. So you use WeChat to message your friends, to split a pizza, has like Venmo-like capabilities, it has Uber-like capabilities. You know, it's truly this incredible, you know, homogenous gumbo of fintech and social capabilities. And I don't know if we're going to necessarily see that, but what you see with Marcus buying, or Goldman's Marcus buying something like Clarity Money, you see Robinhood moving into checking accounts, you see Betterment trying to launch sort of financial advisors and checking. Is there going to be a rebundling of the bank, right? No one actually wants to use 17 different products. Their life doesn't fragment in that way. As a financial, you know, as a human, I don't think of, oh, this is my mortgage hat, and this is my savings hat, and this is my checkings hat, and this is, I live a holistic life. I think most people do. So the opportunity is going to be, in the future, is that going to be that combination of like the tech seamlessness with the kind of holistic picture of yourself? That's certainly what Morgan Stanley is trying to offer. And I think other financial institutions are well positioned to do that too. I think in terms of like who wins in this sort of battle royale between big tech and big bank, it's a hard thing to say. One thing that's really interesting is just how sticky banking is. It's partly because it's a regulated market. It's very hard to kind of unseat these firms. I mean, really, if you look at, as I mentioned, the Monzos and the N26s and the Revoluts that are coming here, they're partnering with regional banks because they can't get banking licenses. But the other thing is, it's also just about, where the default bias lies, right? So there's a heuristic quality, if you've read Nudge, right? There's a heuristic quality to this. Like, why does Sweden or Norway have like a 90% organ donation rate? Well, because it's opt out, not opt in.
Yep.
Some countries have an opt out retirement contribution. Banks are like that, right? You actually have to go and you've got to rip out the thing. It's really hard. It's really hard. If Wells Fargo was a consumer product that you had to go to the store every week and buy off a shelf, it would be out of business. But it's not. You got to do, because you can be angry about it. I'll tell you. I'll give you a story that might explain this, and I, you know, hope they're not listening to this. But HSBC, right? So HSBC bought Midland Bank in the early 90s, maybe the 80s in the UK. And because my parents have banked with Midland Bank since the 60s, I was a Midland Bank customer. I became an HSBC customer when I kind of grew into an adult. And they were, at the time, the campaign slogan was the world's local bank. And so when I first moved to the States in my early 20s, I sort of rocked up very innocently at the HSBC branch in New York. And I said, here I am. Here's my HSBC code. Here's my passport. You know, where's my account? And they laughed at me. And they were like, you know, we're HSBC USA. We're a completely different entity. You don't have an account here. And P.S., you don't have anywhere near enough money for us to take you as a client here. And so I was super angry. And 20 years later, you know, I had this opportunity to write about HSBC, and it just so happens I didn't write particularly favorably about HSBC in my book. I don't know if you've seen, you know, they've got this robot called Pepper, and it's a bit of a cheap shot that we took, but basically kind of made fun a little bit of HSBC. So I got to get my revenge, right, by sort of saying, like, in this world of innovation where banks are really adopting great technologies like blockchain to make things more efficient, or they're launching things like Zelle that mimic, you know, Venmo, HSBC has this robot, this silly robot that dances in its lobbies.
Yep.
And you may think that I kind of have the final joke on that, but the real story, the real punchline to this story is, who do I bank with in the UK still? HSBC. I haven't changed my bank. I was incensed enough to write a chapter about them 20 years later, but I still haven't changed. I haven't got round to changing my bank because it's hard and it's just annoying, and most people don't want to do it.
You started your career in the UK, and it seems like in the UK there's a lot more innovation in fintech, a lot more uptake of new fintech products. Yet there hasn't been a lot of, you know, from what I've heard of the analysis, not a lot of people have switched and made their primary account, say Monzo or Revolut in the UK. Now, even with the account switching service, which has been this for I think 2 years now, what is your take on why the US, why US customers haven't really adopted fintech as much as their European counterparts?
I mean, I think partly the part of the reason is that fintechs in the UK have been around a lot longer, and you know, whether it's Starling Bank or Monzo, they, you know, they've been around a lot further. The things that you have to kind of inculcate, you know, crossing the chasm, right? You've got to kind of bring the customer with you on this journey. And in many ways, the UK, in particular Europe more broadly, is light years ahead, has been doing stuff that we are just getting round to now for many, many years. So chip and PIN, right? I mean, I moved here 20 years ago, so I'm an American, and my experience is American, so it still feels like space when I go to London. You know, the waiter brings over the card machine, contactless for your cards, contactless on the subway, you know, things that really, they literally are just launching right this second on the New York subway. The idea that you can tap and go. Well, that's been around in London for nearly 10 years. Contactless payments. I mean, when I have to go over there with my credit card and stick it in and sign it with a pen, they look at me like I just walked off, you know, I don't know, walked out of a swamp, like I'm some sort of caveman. They don't know what to make of me. So I think consumers have been inculcated, if you like, been sort of educated about sort of just more mobile, more digitally native. I think that's, you know, we're just on the cusp of that stuff here in the States. So I think that's part of why is they've got a, you know, consumers have been educated along these lines for a lot longer than US consumers. I think the other thing that certainly made fintechs, the life of fintechs easier, is a single regulator, right? You know, the FCA in the UK is one regulator. If you try and bank in this country, if you don't want to be a bank in this country, it's not a joke to say you could be working with 70 different regulators, 50 for each of the states, and then any number of, depending on what kind of services you want to offer, you know, securities regulators and FDIC and FINRA and, you know, OCC, and the list goes on. I'm still discovering regulators. I mean, I've been working in the American financial system for 20 years. I'm still finding regulators I didn't know about.
Going back to your book, there, you know, I know that in the book you kind of, you interview a couple of sort of the early fintech pioneers in the U.S. Can you speak to maybe some of the more interesting stories that you uncovered?
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, I also interviewed people in the U.K. I mean, one of the most interesting guys started the business in London, which is Ishmael Ahmed, who was the CEO, is the founder of World Remit. And he's just an absolutely fascinating individual. I would just say that, like, across the board, everyone I spoke to turned out to be just really interesting. When I called them misfits, which I do so affectionately, you know, that's true. They're not bankers. And so they've all typically got really weird backstories. So, you know, Steve Street, who created Green Dot, which is probably the number one finance institution for the underbanked in the United States, had a prior life in the music industry. He coined the term soft rock. So whenever we talk about soft rock, you've got Steve Street to thank for that. So like really weird backstories, but that kind of fit the theme, which is that, you know, the people that brought you the last 10 years of the way you interact with your money weren't from inside traditional financial firms. Renaud Laplanche, who created Lending Club and kind of invented the concept of peer-to-peer lending, you know, was a lawyer who became a consultant, who became a tech entrepreneur. Adam Dell, who brought you Clarity Money, which is now part of Goldman Sachs. He was the first institutional investor in OpenTable. And so they're all bringing this kind of slightly different perspective. Ishmael Ahmed, who I mentioned earlier, was a refugee from Somalia who, in the 80s, during the Somali Civil War, basically hid in the base of a truck to get out of Hargeisa, which is where there was this massive Holocaust, frankly, happening, sort of ethnic cleansing, and relied on money sent to him by his brother to get to London, where he had a scholarship to go to university. And then when he found out that his family was safe, started sending money back home from his jobs, and encountered firsthand the kind of the friction of the remittances world, which is how you know, sending money across borders. And that made that the focus of his economics degree, rose to become the head of the remittance program for the United Nations. And then, you know, just unbelievably uncovers this scandal inside the United Nations. He finds this like cover up of you know, illegal financial wrongdoing, and becomes a whistleblower, and got like completely blacklisted by the UN, fired by the UN, sued the UN, won, and then uses that money to start World Remit. So, you know, many of the people we spoke to.
You know, your typical startup story,
just
right?
Just a classic regular, yeah, exactly. Very much like the regular. I'm sure if you just ask your financial advisor to tell you their backstory, it'll sound something very, very similar. Like, yeah, you know, just get your Morgan Stanley, your Merrill Lynch financial advisor, and just ask them about how they came to be.
It takes that kind of outsider view, right, to see the gaps and the holes, and the very innovator's dilemma kind of
it's extremely Christensen. Where... Yeah, and look, I mean, throughout history, right, people have been saying this. Bobby Kennedy said, some people see the world the way it is and ask why. I see the way it could be and I ask why not. Henry Ford said, if I'd asked my customers what they wanted, you know, they'd have told me a faster horse. Steve Jobs said, your customers fundamentally don't know what you want, what they want, until you show it to them. So there's these, I think there's these two forms of innovation. I think there's this kind of Edisonian light bulb innovation where you just disappear into a cave and you just come at it from a completely blank piece of paper. And then I think on the other hand, you've got this kind of incrementalist collaborative form of innovation where you listen to your customers and you iterate, and you make it better. And I think throughout history, there are, you know, moments and companies that are really, really good at one, and moments and companies that are really, really, you know, primed for the other type.
Oh, well, you mentioned the customers not knowing what they want, but the kind of the incumbent companies kind of make excuses for their product that's not improving as well. They're not incentivized to push further, to go beyond, or to have an outsider view. Or a contrarian view?
I think they were improving. I think they were just improving the wrong things. I mean, I think, you know, the reality is I worked in fintech before fintech was sexy, before fintech meant what it meant today. So 20 years ago, people said, what do you do? I said, I work in fintech. And that would be an immediate conversation killer, right? You'd never be invited back to the dinner party.
You'd be
right? Today, you're like the coolest guy at the dinner party. People are like, oh, that's cool. How do I set up my Acorns account or my Robinhood account? So when I worked in fintech, it was all like ultra low latency technology platforms for traders, right, who were trying to trade all these complex derivatives, the stuff that got us into trouble in 2008. So, you know, no one was talking about consumer lending or consumers, frankly, you know, retail consumers. One of the people I interviewed in the book was working in banking, I think this was in the early 2000s, and he heard this expression lobby trash, and he thought that the bankers were talking about, you know, someone had literally left, you know, bags of trash in the lobby. But no, lobby trash meant, you know, retail consumers. It's what the banks called, is what those was banks were calling them, lobby trash. So I think they weren't.
That, yeah.
Lobby trash, get out, lobby trash. Yeah. I just think that they weren't, you know, they didn't know where their customers were or were going to be. And they invested a huge amount in a lot of very complicated stuff that blew up. And another reason that 2008 is this moment in time is, you know, they learned the wrong lesson. They you know, the whole Big Short story, top to bottom, teaches banks in 2008 the absolute wrong lesson. They had a system of selling products to people who couldn't afford them, so subprime, and they had tech-enabled complexity in the shape of these instruments and derivatives and constructions and asset classes that were for a while making them a lot of money. And when that all blew up and all the banks were right on a knife's edge, they said, that's it. We're not going to lend to people who can't afford it. And we're not going to use tech to innovate because innovation is fundamentally bad. And that came at the exact moment that, firstly, you know, the structure of this country was changing such that actually there's a lot of money to be made in the small dollar customers, as proven now by Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Uber, and many others. And they actually needed credit. And then the second thing is, you know, you had these diaspora of tech innovators, like the people I just mentioned, people out of OpenTable, people out of Google, people out of their own tech platforms, who saw this vacuum and they were like, well, we can use these nascent technologies to deliver financial services. So like Facebook, you know, when, not many people remember, but peer-to-peer lending, like OnDeck, well, particularly Lending Club, started on Facebook. You know, mobile internet, it's not that old. But you couldn't have products and platforms that started in 2008, like Credit Karma, which, by the way, is just, you know, Intuit's just about to buy for $7 billion. You couldn't have had that without the iPhone.
You sort of highlight here the launch of the iPhone as an inflection point in the adoption of fintech. And I think that we're seeing, or we've seen for the past couple of years at least, maybe the idea that cryptocurrency will maybe become the next thing that will drive the next generation of fintech innovation. And I understand that you have a pretty interesting story about your interactions with Blythe Masters.
So Blythe is very, very smart. I'm filming with her on Thursday, and I'll be speaking with her on South by Southwest. On a panel on these topics. So Blythe is obviously credited with many things. She's an incredibly smart woman. One of the things she created was the credit default swap that people kind of put at the heart of the 2008 crisis. It's actually a risk, risk mitigating asset that she created. Very, very smart. It was, the idea is to reduce risk, and the way it was used, obviously, and abused, sort of amplified risk inside the financial system. So 2008 is an important year for Blythe Masters too, because a lot of, you know, she is the person who sometimes got called like the creator of the financial weapons of mass destruction. Obviously, she rejects that. She rejects that moniker, and I think with good reason. But she already had a story. And she's a phenom. I mean, she was working in JP Morgan as an intern from 18. She probably, I don't know when she created the credit default swap, but I think she was in her very early 20s. She was one of the youngest managing directors there. And just she's phenomenal. And she really didn't understand Bitcoin or blockchain. And I think it was her ex-husband was splitting a bill with her and made her go and get Bitcoin, because he, like as a joke or a prank, he kind of paid her back in Bitcoin, and it kind of forced her to kind of look at this. And I think her mind was on the crisis. Her mind had been on the crisis. That's another important thing, by the way, that comes out in 2008, is the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper. Mm-hmm. And when it did, by the way, it was directly aimed at the financial crisis. It says so in the white paper. It's really about the genesis of that, the very germ of it, is about disintermediation. It's about decentralization, right? So look at what these big central counterparty intermediary things like banks and central banks, look what they've done to the market. You know, surely there's a better way. And I think Blythe kind of understood that power. But she also, you can take the girl out of Wall Street, but you can't take Wall Street out of the girl. Like, I think what she also understood was its application, blockchain, not so much cryptocurrency, but blockchain, the application of that to make things more efficient, even within those organizations like exchanges or clearing houses or the DTCC that are by nature intermediaries. In other words, the people who created blockchain were like, to put it in the simplest possible terms, they were like, aha, we're going to get rid of all these banks, we're going to get rid of all these exchanges, we're going to get rid of all these intermediaries, we're going to move to a decentralized financial system. And Blythe Masters whose kind of DNA is in the financial system is like, not so fast. These guys actually do good work, but let's use blockchain technology to make it a more efficient, a cheaper, a better experience. And so it's ironic
rid of
in
a way.
Different
kind of middlemen, yeah, or the central and back office, all that kind of work to verify everything. And
yeah, I mean, and you know, to date, the biggest adopters of decentralized technology, of blockchain technology, are institutional players, the people it was designed to get rid of, right? Yep. So there's an inherent tension there. And I'd say, by the way, that tension extends to cryptocurrency, right? You know, when you look at the big whales inside the cryptocurrency space, you know, a lot of them are former financiers. When people talk about gold, people talk about it as a new gold or a flight to safety, you know, it's institutional money that's going there. I mean, without the participation for either blockchain or cryptocurrency of the very people that some sort of crypto nerds kind of hate, right? Sort of just picture your bank, just picture your kind of like your worst nightmare.
Establishment.
Yeah, picture the man, right? He's wearing a suit, he works on Wall Street, like, you know, and then, you know, DLT and blockchain and crypto is designed to like beat that guy. Like the sad, you know, truth that these anti-establishment folks need to understand is like without that guy's participation, either, you know, because they're using blockchain in their exchange or they built a desk to trade cryptocurrency, like, it's that stuff that's keeping your dream alive.
One thing I harp on is that we haven't seen a lot of blockchain projects go into production. We always hear about the infamous POC, the proof of concept, the testing, and then no actual product coming out of that, perpetual testing. So are you saying that there's some of that going in, just starting to go in the back end, things that don't get a big press release?
So. And to be honest, I mean, listen, I'm not, you know, I was told there'd be no math on this test. Like, I'm a writer pretending to be a crypto nerd. I'm an English and French literature major. So like, you know, can I tell you which particular distributed ledger technology, you know, POCs have moved to production? No, I can't. I do know that one of the things that Blythe, speaking of Blythe, is doing now, I think she's on the board or working closely with Figure, and they're using blockchain. And when I spoke to her, you know, I think she was very proud of the fact that, you know, it's fully in production. You know, they use blockchain from beginning to end. There was in the mortgage space from origination, you know, all the way through the chain is based on sort of working blockchain technology. So I think, you know, there are going to be examples out there if you care to look for them.
So what do you think is interesting out there for new fintechs that are just starting out? What makes you excited?
Stuff that I'm super excited about, right, is kind of that next evolution of fintech. We have a problem economically in this country, right? So 50% of Americans don't have $400 in emergency savings. We have a real crisis, and it's being precipitated by sort of macroeconomic factors that are affecting the West. Wages have pretty much stagnated or gone backwards in real terms. Assets have appreciated enormously, particularly in the last 10 years, because technology has enabled companies to go asset light. So people who are in the assets world have experience, you know, wealth they never dreamed of, and the people who are in the wages world haven't just stayed the same, they've gone backwards because their cost of living has gone up, you know, and their costs are fixed. And then to add to insult to injury, you know, technology has essentially made, you know, past the responsibility that companies once had to buffer their employees from the ebbs and flows of business. Any company that's in that business, like a retail company, where it says, listen, we'll pay you and you just show up and we'll wait till Black Friday to make a profit, they're going out of business. I mean, it's a retail apocalypse here in New York. Companies that have passed that ebb and flow onto their workers So Amazon warehouse employees or Uber drivers, you know, they're essentially taking the responsibilities of the companies in terms of feeling the ebb and flow of money with none of the benefits. So you add all of that together and you've got a pretty dire situation. I mean, it also explains the incumbent in the White House and Brexit too. So we have a real problem. And I think some of it's a problem that policy can solve. That maybe we do need a wealth tax. Maybe we do need to redistribute money. Maybe we do need minimum wage policy. I mean, that's for someone else to think about as far as I'm concerned. But I do think the technology can help to solve some of these problems. Because if you earn money in fits and spurts, you need credit. You need credit, not the way we need credit. I don't, you know, I would only take credit to buy a house or a big screen TV or maybe lease a car. But you need credit just to get through till next week because there's a big lumpiness to your income and you have a massive income volatility. So we need to find ways of measuring them and the credit worthiness that aren't traditional ways, like take a paycheck and let me see your pay stub, right? And many traditional financial institutions still don't know how to deal with those kinds of consumers. So we need to find ways to give them working capital for their individual lives. If we're going to treat each one like a little company or a 1099 employee, we need ways to give them working capital. We need to make it easier for them to live a financial life if they are going to be 1099 employees. I'm a textiles, Barclays Textiles mentor, and there was a great company called 1099 Made Easy, and I thought it was a really good idea to make these 1099 workers easier. I think fractional payment is really interesting. I think the idea that you show up and your employer is now passing on this work to you in fits and spurts and you're doing horrible shifts and you might be forced to take voluntary time off and all these other horrible things that are being passed on to employees, I think it's an insult to injury that they have to wait 2 weeks to get paid. I think you do a shift, you should get paid. So we need to invest in technology to understand fractional payments and get money into people's pockets quicker. So technology, I think, can solve some of these problems in a way that's kind of policy light, right? That doesn't necessarily seek to solve the question, should we tax the rich more? And I hope that there are ideas that sort of everyone can kind of get behind. You know, a day's pay for a day's work should be a relatively sort of bipartisan kind of thing. So that's what I'm excited by, is like technology that can solve the real problem. It's great that I can split a pizza with my friends in New York. You know, it's great. It's great that Uber has removed the payment experience for me and made it so seamless. It's great that Apple now enables me to permission, you know, things from Amazon just by looking at my face. All of that is lovely, but I don't believe it's really solving real people's problems. And at least 50% of this country has some real problems that technology, I think, can help solve.
That's a good spot as I need to end it. Thank you very much, Dan. When can our readers find the book?
April 14th. Then you can. It comes out April 14th, and you can, if you just search the Money Hackers in Amazon, you'll find it. And please go and pre-order.
Thanks for joining us, and we appreciate your time.
Hey, it's my pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.